Welcome back to the Sea Mask podcast. On Friday, we lost a guy. We didn't kill him either. Everything's still good. He's coming back next Friday, Mr. Mike Pantile, our newest addition to the crew. He's just visiting some family. We wish him all the best. And
No
next
one
week's
believed us, by the
yeah,
way.
we just have a shed full of Sea Mask guests. We're
Shed
going
full
through
of
them.
Spinal Tap drummers who just explode spontaneously. No, he's coming back. Sorry.
Yeah, and
Sorry.
it'll be his inaugural show. I don't know if the audience has figured this out yet, but we rotate through who runs each show. And this week is my week, and this week it is brought to you by Us by Return, the matchmaking service that Mr. Timothy J. Gordon and Mr. Will Noland are the matchmakers of. It's been a very successful first 6 months to 9 months here. We have one engagement in the tank, a few more right on its heels. So, if you are a young Catholic man or Christian or Catholic woman willing to convert, who's looking to get married in the next 12, 18 at the latest months, we said 18 to start with, but it's actually, if you guys are serious about this, it really shouldn't take that long. Then join, go to retvrn.us and apply, and we'll love to take a look at your application and get you hitched. So today's going to be a Q&A show, and I spent some time yesterday evening thinking about if I were the audience, what questions would I be asking the CMAS crew? Most of these I won't answer because they're directed at men with more life experience than me. A couple of these I do have answers for and we'll join in. But to start with, I want to begin on something that's been on my mind lately, which is the idea of how much men should work, what kind of success they should be pursuing, and when it's enough. And so the first question is, have you guys heard of the story of the fisherman and the businessman? Heard this anecdote or story?
Not that I can think of. I'd love to hear it though.
You guys may have heard it after I start telling it, but essentially you have an islander, a fisherman, and it's in the early morning, and he's out there fishing from the pier, and a businessman comes up and basically says, "Well, what are you doing?" He's like, "I'm fishing." And he's like, "Well, how many fish do you catch?" He's like, "A couple every day. It's enough for me and my family." And then I get to go home and spend the rest of the evening with my family. And he goes, "You know, if instead of going home to your family this evening, you spent a couple more hours every day fishing, you could sell those fish and you could hire a local boy to fish with you, and you could double your money." And he goes, "Well, why would I do that?" He says, "Well, with those extra profits from this local boy, you could eventually buy a boat. You could go out and you could fish where there's more fish out there." He's like, and why would I do that?" He's like, "Well, because with that added revenue, you could get two boats and start to form your own fishing company." He goes, "Well, why would I do that?" He says, "Well, off the coast of America, there's a canning company, and they could can your fish that you catch and then import them into America, and you could make lots of money." He goes, "Well, why would I do that?" And this goes on for a little bit, and eventually he goes, "Well, and you know, why would I do that?" And he goes, "Well, because then you wouldn't have to work and you could go home to your family and relax in the evenings."
Which he could have
And
done.
which he's actively doing. And a few of these things have been sort of bombarding me lately, where I fully understand that most guys don't have the trouble of working too hard. I know that's not really their vice. But to you guys, what should be the definition of success for the average Catholic man? And then what's the limiter that they should put on their ambition so that they don't become this greedy businessman, but they also don't fall into sloth? Where's that pocket? Hey, we'll start with you, Tim. Or Will, if you want to ponder.
I'd never thought of the boundary conditions, but the condition whereupon one can go home and enjoy time with their family while it's still light outside is a novel set of conditions, let's call them, in the history of human life. And it's a win. I'm not saying that someone that works extra hours for part of a season or a year is out of order, but the grounding condition should be, wow, the fact that if I get home at 5 or 4, once I went back to teaching, I left the law and went back to teaching, which I'd done before. And I was like, holy cow, this is block schedule. I get off at 1:30 half the days and 2:45 the others. This is amazing. And it was a decent salary for a teacher. So I was like, I felt like I won the lottery. That was the best job I ever had. I was getting paid almost twice as much at the same job that I'd been at before because I had more degrees. Somewhere between making my starting salary at the Catholic high school that I taught at and making the salary that I was making at the time that I was, that I forcefully stopped working. That's the boundary condition somewhere in there. When you're going home early, you have plenty of time with your family. You're not wanting for much. Still wasn't tons of money, but it was significantly more than you know you're approximating what you're supposed to be approximating. That's the best answer I can give. And wanting to work much more for more than a year or two, if you have a very discrete goal, unlike your paradigm story, gets the G word, greedy, avaricious. That's what I say. But you should be able to be happy hanging your hat on, I have a job, I work relatively minimal hours, I'm getting off when it's this many hours of daylight left, and I really enjoy my family. Even if those two things hang in the balance together, you have a goal where you want to get, you should be able to stop and smell the roses and admire your life for what it gives you and your family.
Will, what say you?
Yeah, I like that point. And just to underscore the main message there, it's about doing something that's time efficient. I've made the point before that a guy who earns double the US national wage, which is 65K, but working around 35 hours a week, roughly. Let's say he's up to 130K and he thinks he's pretty hot stuff. He's way up there in the percentile points, but then he sees that he's working 70 hours a week versus the guy earning 65 for 35 to 40 hour week. Are you really more successful? Remembering that the main purpose of your job is to provide a modest level of material comfort for your family, and then the truly important provider role comes to the fore, which is moral and spiritual provision. You are leaving your wife without companionship and your kids without leadership, especially when they're teenagers, because you're so focused on the grind. And the more you earn, the more the tax man takes anyway, the higher up you go. So there's diminishing returns. And I've done this, as most guys who really like to do well at whatever they put their hand to. And if you also have an edge of a go hard or go home personality, which I do in pretty much all areas of life, I've got injuries in the gym because of it. I've got a dog that's extremely hard work because of it, because I wanted to get a harder breed to learn more about some of the hard facts of nature rather than something that's soft. It's been good for me in some ways, but man, it's a headache. So that go hard or go home personality, guys with that especially need to watch out for it, because you can get sucked in and you have to learn the hard way if you're a knucklehead like me, but I have done.
So that's a perfect segue to the next question. And Tim, I read you this thread and I was pleased to know that my gut instinct in tweeting this was not far off from sort of where you sat on the issue as well. So Aristotle says that there's a natural aristoi, a natural aristocracy, and a natural slave class, and that 99% of people are fit for cattle. And I think to our modern ears, that sounds a bit more pejorative. He's not saying in my opinion, that there's good people and scum of the earth that are like, you know, should just be shoe shiners and shit shovelers, but rather that the vast majority of people are to be employees and they're to be farmers, and that area for them is natural and comfortable and in accordance with their capacities. And a very, very, very small percentage of people are aristocrats. They're going to be generals. They're going to be thinkers who define eras. They're going to be artists and kings and so on and so forth. And in this thread that I tweeted, I said that America kind of screwed this all up because it made it seem like every person could become part of the aristocracy, and that Valhalla was for gods and heroes. And so if you want to get to Valhalla, you have to become either a god or a hero. And they sort of sold this bill of goods to everyone in the U.S. that, well, really, success is, happiness is, you're making millions. You're driving the car, all this materialism stuff. But also, I think even more subtle than that, they said, it's adding something that no one else can add. You've got to be contributing to society in this unique, special snowflake kind of way that only you can do. And I think what that results in is total atomization and this lack of humility, not seeing yourself as God sees you. And so it forces people, especially young men, or compels them to do what you just described, Will, which is they're not going to stop until they're in the 1% of the 1% in this particular niche, contributing their special snowflake uniqueness to the world. When 999 times out of 1,000, that's not what they're built for. They don't really have that. And they should, as quickly as possible, humble themselves, which is to say, see themselves as God sees them, and fall into that pocket of their vocation. And so I promise I'm getting to the question. The question is the difference between a calling and a vocation. Do you guys think that most men have a calling toward a specific career path or a specific task to accomplish with their life? A God-given, you need to go out and do this. Or do the vast majority of men have a vocation and they should do whatever job facilitates being a good husband and father? We'll start with you, Will.
So the interesting thing with this is that God doesn't owe us any particular gifts. And Tim will be able to explain this in better detail, but grace itself isn't distributed fairly from our perspective. It's not something we're strictly owed in justice. So there are people. My normal example is someone like Aquinas or Aristotle, who get this almost superhuman intellect, and it's on them to use that for God's glory. And what a shame it would have been if those two hadn't ever put pen to paper. But for most of us, we don't have anything like that. We have interests and we have aptitudes and proclivities, and we're better at some things than others, but it's all very modest. And if you look at the bell curve, you're not going to be a world changer in the way that those two were, or even some people like Nietzsche, for example, who's nowhere near those, but is still a smart dude, but misused his gifts, largely writing nonsense. So it comes with that risk too. But most people just need to go out and accept that their main purpose in life is laying up treasure in heaven, not trying to make some kind of shattering impact on the world around them. Because success in this life doesn't really determine success in life overall. You can be a humble farmer or a plumber or electrician who just punches the clock, but is a great dad. And that's it. and you've done your duty and you've actually had a more successful life than a guy who might have invented something, which is pretty cool and changes car engines for all time after he dies. So my dad, when I was a kid and I was talking about what I might want to be when I was older and coming up with different jobs, he just said, look, you do realize that most people don't ever have this choice. They just do whatever job is available in the area near to them. And they might have to switch jobs a few times. They might have to get laid off. And they're not living their dream at all. But they're just doing what it takes to put food on the table and a roof over the head of their families. And that's the really important thing. So that always stuck with me. You don't need to have some particular dream career.
Now, Tim, that would seem to fly in the face of everything Will just said, would seem to fly in the face of the red pill paradigm that you must be an outlier in order to get the hottest women. And if you don't constantly accelerate in your marriage toward some crazier goal each year, your wife won't have enough dread in her and she will flee to the next most successful man. Would you share some thoughts on that?
Well, that's counter-natural. It's counter-anthropological. It's counter-Christian. And I'll just build on the framework Will built. Everybody has a vocation insofar as God calls and wills everyone to heaven. The vocation is largely but not wholly defined ex post, after the fact. And there have been enough human stories in salvation history such that we can define, even though it was probably ex post for the first humans, for most men, marriage and family is the path to heaven. After Christ came here and made a Jewish marital contract into a sacrament, the catechism says, raising marriage to the dignity of a sacrament. That's what Jesus did at the wedding feast of Cana. Then it became crystal clear, ex ante, before the fact. This is the vocation of most men who suffer concupiscence badly. For those few, Nietzsche would hate this. The red pill would hate it, and therefore I love to articulate it. Well, I like Nietzsche. I don't love the red pill. But the natural aristoi should be the priestly class, just like Nietzsche stood on his head, because these are men that do not need the non-proscribed incursions against chastity. Mm. That's obviously not what we've had, and that's not what we've had throughout various intermittent periods of church history. But the point is, there are basically two vocations, callings to heaven, and they are marriage and family, if you don't become a priest or religious, or the other path is be priest or religious. Your life will be marked by celibacy either way. Jobs are not a calling. I agree with the advice that Will's dad gave him. Your job is not, I mean, a calling's just a anglified redefinition of vocation. Vocation means wokat, you know, to call. So no, that's just one of these things we do in English, the biggest language of all time, the most words of all the languages and spoken by the smartest people, is we'll take ideas, we'll pilfer them from other cultures, and we'll say, oh, that's not a vocation, this is a calling. Well, it's a cognate, dude. And this is what the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, namely the Puritans, did in early American history. They just say, I'm always citing this Weber quote, pulling from Baxter, saying that the earning of the daily bread is a substitution for sacraments as part of the new early Protestant Reformation. And common men are using it as a source of quotidian grace. This is precisely what the Protestants gave us, is a false anglified version of vocation, which is to say your job is your special calling. You hear young people say this all the time. It also happened increasingly as universities became glorified trade schools, bastardized. So yeah, vocation, everyone does have, but your vocation is non-profession specific. You're either going, God intended you either to be a priest or a married man, and you should do either one according to whether you are called to it. Most men are called to the married life, and you should do either one very, very well. And if you are Bob Cratchit, to go back to that, because we're not that far removed from Christmas, you might be a clerk, as Bob is, but you can still be the best at the married vocation, as Bob is, even though he's presumably an Anglican Protestant. So the final note is the natural aristoi in Aristotle has also been anglified to have something to do with your profession. Aristotle's talking about natural talent that's been realized, and he's talking about moral and intellectual virtues. There's a middle class there. He says, people estimate what he means, the men who lead the apolaustic life, the pleasure-seeking life. As I told Andrew Tate, it was an Aristotle quote. Someone saw it online and called it out. I said, you lead a life fit for cattle. Aristotle says that 90 to 95% of men lead the apolaustic life, a life fit for fucking cattle. It's a shame. This has to hurt. Imagine how this has to hurt our creator. You know, 5 to 7% lead a life of honor or the life of politics. Americans in our political situation, we laugh at that. That the life of honor is synonymous with the life of politics, where you do seek not pleasure. Now you seek honor, but honor is the high esteem of others, but not just any others. Aristotle says it's the life of seeking good repute from the best person you know. He says that's pretty good. That's a lot closer to the life of eudaimonia, which is the life of true happiness that only 1 or 2% will seriously strive for. The difference is you're still defining it exteriorly. What, you know, virtue through the eyes of, here's this kid Ambrose. He's the valedictorian of class and he's a moral guy. I want to earn his repute. That's a pretty good surrogate for a life of virtue, true virtue, but it's not the real thing. The life of true virtue that the true natural aristoi really shadow is you do the right thing for the right reason under all the right circumstances and exactly the right time as the right-minded man would do it. And there's just, it seems like everyone would be pursuing this life, the truly aristocratic life, but amor fati, only true natural aristoi even pursue it. We're not talking about perfection. I think Henry James says, excellence does not require perfection. Of course not. Only the natural aristoi seriously pursue even the life of eudaimonia.
Fantastic, fantastic answer. Keeping on the theme of priestly class and burning with passion, and thus we become married and so on. Will, you, I've heard you say that the virtue of chastity is the same before marriage as it is after marriage. And I had always equated chastity is you don't have sex until marriage. So I'm missing something. Can you explain what you mean by that phrase?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So chastity is about the control of your sexual appetites. And whether you are married or not, you have to do that. An example would be a guy when he isn't married shouldn't be putting himself into occasions of sin where he's going to be lusting or taking things too far during courtship, for example. So he has to have that willpower to dominate what his impulses are. And we recognize that because of original sin, we are prone to disorder in all kinds of ways, and that vice comes easily to us. Virtue's hard work. A married man also has to do the same thing. So he might have thoughts or desires about women who aren't his wife, for example, and he shouldn't be entertaining those. He should be squashing them straight away and praying for the grace to resist temptation. So what we see is that whether he's married or not, he always has to make sure that his appetites follow his reason rather than vice versa. Now, this myth that you can somehow get it out of your system before you're married is crazy when you understand what chastity is, because a vice or a virtue is a habit that is ingrained by repeated action. And you are weakening your resistance to sin, to temptation, every time you give into it. And it can become a second nature in a bad way, just like virtue is second nature in a good way. So a guy who was always given in to looking at women's bodies when he goes to the gym, for example, or down the street, or has always gratified whatever sexual impulse he might feel, he's going to have those patterns of behavior in him, and it's going to have shaped his character too, taking it into the marriage. So this is why, if you look at the hard stats, promiscuity before marriage roughly doubles the risk of divorce, because he's going in as a kind of cripple in terms of chastity, because he hasn't trained himself. And I once heard a priest say that the reason that God gets teenage boys fired up with sexual desire before they're actually ready to get married. The question was, well, how come we feel this way if we're too young to get married? And the answer was so great. It was that it's to give you time to learn to actually be in charge of it and to control it, because you're going to have to do that when you're married as well. Otherwise, you'll make a mess of your marriage. Wow. So you're flexing the same muscle, training it before marriage to get it under control.
Interesting. So I was misguided by whatever, perhaps Catholic education or the cultural understanding of chastity, to make it seem like there was never supposed to be an outlet for those feelings, that those feelings, desires, impulses, and orientations were all bad, and you had to destroy them completely. And what I'm hearing you say is that there's just one expression of them that is licit and moral and celebrated, and that is with your wife.
We're sorry that you have no outlet for your disordered orientation.
Hey, I'm living the higher life of celibacy. No.
That was a Skittles joke.
Yeah, no, I know. Now everybody, now all the CMS audience thinks I'm single because I'm
afraid. No, he's not. There needs to be more bro like slurs, which is all it is. When Nick and I get together, it's just Matt, my friend Matt Marsden posted something the other day that was like, men bond through insults they don't mean. Women bond through compliments they don't mean. It's a great, great thing. Anyway, it's true. And it's definitely true on the male part that I'm not saying you're.
Which is why bullying isn't always bad. It's one of my controversial opinions when I was a teacher. Bullying isn't always bad. Sometimes it's the best thing for a kid.
Always. Always. You learn to go lift weights, son. Don't sing in the choir before you've lifted weights. You've earned your right to sing in the choir if you still want to after you've lifted weights, but you can't sing like a canary unless you can defend it. Boy.
Tim, if in this understanding of chastity, is it possible then to lust after your wife?
I mean, conceptually, yeah, there's an astronomical mathematical space where you can lust after your wife by imagining in a sinful way, fantasizing about acts that aren't licit, I suppose, but it's rather theoretical, and I don't think it's a cause of marriages breaking out. A guy imagining a different kind of coitus with his wife, I don't recommend it, and it I think theoretically could be sinful. I don't think it's so. Yeah, theoretically, yes, there is space where you can lust after your wife. I'm just giving a definite answer by definitions. But I don't think this is any great danger. Yeah.
Yeah. In the spirit of like that. So that reflex of see pretty girl, desire pretty girl. And you've mastered that, and you've practiced, and you've chained this, and now you're a relatively chaste man through years of celibacy in your youth. And then one day you see pretty girl, you desire pretty girl, and you make that girl your wife. And all of those things, which you weren't suppressing, you were controlling. You weren't rooting out, you were just becoming the master of. Is there anything immoral or illicit about then directing those at this one woman that you've now wed?
No, I mean, no, no. If you're talking about real acts, in the way me, Will and I did the Catholic marital sexual ethics show that pissed a bunch of people off. And we were supposedly the big liberals on that just for following basically all the moral manualists of the early 20th century, pre-Vatican II. Well, manual is within those confines, then I would say no. But there are some confines is all I'm saying. That's all I was trying to express in the first part of my answer, is that there are some boundaries still on licit marital acts, marital sexuality. But yeah, if you kind of throw all of your will to be pervy at one woman, but it's still bounded by the marital function and set of teleological grand unifying functions, then I would say that it's not a major risk. Now, let's say that lusting after your wife feels like we're getting puritanical if this is something you're confessing in confession. Unless
I am not, as I have no wife after whom to lust.
You're objectively lifeless. Yeah.
I actually think that this is one of the reasons why a lot of married Christian men struggle with porn and similar problems. Having worked with people like that, often the reason is because they're not fantasizing about their wives.
That's kind of why I'm asking this. Yeah.
It's actually morally good to fantasize about doing acts with your wife that are morally good.
Yeah.
That's why I'm asking, Will, is because
so I'm like, guys, just think about her in her underwear. And her body's a good thing for you to have in mind. And you can think about having sex with her in the evening. You should be excited about the thought of impregnating her. This is what marriage is all about as a natural institution. So it's not like dirty or pervy for a guy to do that, or to look at his wife, or to buy her some nice lingerie and say, wow, you look great. This is all normal, natural, morally good stuff for a guy to do.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that, Will. That's what I've been getting at, because that's, I think, completely lost. That that chastity means destruction of the sexual desire, as opposed to orienting it toward its proper function. And so the thought is like, all right, well, this kid has spent some years in high school addicted to porn, and then realizes, okay, that's bad. And then he's tries not to look at women lustfully. He's like, 'cause he realizes that's bad. And then he finally gets married, and now he's just in this practice of like, get it out. Don't think about it. This is bad. And not realizing that that's the one place where it actually engenders grace in unity with the wife. And so I don't know, I thought that was really important to emphasize, and something that I've definitely thought about, where it's like, because I don't know, there's like this almost masochism, well, I guess it'd be Manichaeism, that Catholics have, that they're like, anything good, it's probably bad. If you like it, it's probably bad. If you like your wife, you're probably sinning, you know.
Catholics began borrowing that within recent history from like Puritan Protestants. We've done it with the holidays. We've done it with marital sexual ethics. We've done it with some, not all of the trappings of science that have proven themselves more trustworthy, mainstream hard sciences. we've done it, it feels like, with, in some ways, with natural theology, which is like the main distinguisher between Catholicism and Protestantism cosmologically. So it, we're just, I don't know why, but something about the context of the late 20th, early 21st century pseudo requires an incautious Catholic, he feels, to lift Puritanism from Protestantism and to situate it in a Catholic space. And without knowing it, that this is what he confuses for the only way a Catholic can be serious minded. I think it's much better to just be like, as much as I can, as often as I can, I'm going to go to Latin Mass instead of the Novus Ordo. I think that's a healthy way to accomplish the good iteration of that. But this does seem to be a Catholic thing where we'll cross those four or five categories. We seem to be trying to be more Puritan. Will, could I just ask you, do you have that stat showing that promiscuity before marriage roughly doubles the percent chance of divorce? Because that's like a planet killer for the red pill. I mean, that's it. Do you have that? You have every statistic I've ever wanted. I think it's incredible.
Yeah, I can send you the study for that. I'll grab it.
I mean, that's humongous. That ends the red pill conversation, because it's not about, oh, Christian this or Jehoshaphat that, you know, the way they try to dismiss us as being like the wimpy Christians. That's just a natural step. That's a natural proof.
Well, what they'll say is that promiscuity is our innate nature. They'll just say that marriage isn't natural. We're not monogamous. And then what you'd say back is, well, what exactly is wrong with women having high body counts then? What is wrong with the sexual revolution? Mm-hmm. What are you guys bitching about? This is just people being people, right?
Right.
Yeah. This is what happens when you dispense with all standards. Then you can't appeal to standards of any kind later on in your arguments.
Right. Yeah.
You're right, though. There is something odd here. It's a deep misconception, because I got a lot of backlash for saying that guys should fantasize about their wives more, and women actually like to be objectified and sexualized, because guess what? It's one of the things that they are built for, is giving men sexual pleasure, and they take pleasure in doing that. And that's a good thing to be doing. So if a guy likes to buy his wife some outfits that she wouldn't wear on the street out of concern for modesty, but wants to turn things up in the sheets, down in the streets, up in the sheets. Some guys are like, oh, no, I can't do that. But surprise, surprise, she likes it. He likes it. It strengthens the marriage. And you can watch her walk around the house in those outfits when the kids are asleep, and you can flirt with her. And this is all ways of drawing each other closer to each other. It's a good thing. But guys are squeamish about it. They think they're doing something naughty.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's also probably because a lot of women have reprimanded them for that sexual appetite throughout their entire lives. And even in strongly, strongly in modern television, a husband who wants sex from his wife is just berated and belittled. I would say belittled more than berated. Like, you small man, you're an animal. You just have these carnal desires. Like, I'm over here, this beautiful woman, and I would never touch you. You know, I'm thinking Modern Family and shows like this. So guys think like, well, not only that, but also men have been rejected so thoroughly in practice that they think like the scariest thing, I think, for a man would be, all right, I've gotten married, and now what if she rejects my sexual advances in marriage? Like, oh, I should just end it. Like, why in the world am I married then? Why have I done all this? If I'm going to initiate sex with my wife and she's going to be like, no, nah, not interested. Knife to the heart. My goodness, that's the scariest thing you can imagine.
Well, a lot of the times that's because they are uncomfortable with the very kinds of behavior that would actually go towards making up good flirting and turn the wife on. They just think if they look at her and they're aroused, she's going to be aroused as well. So the men are actually afraid to send text messages that help get her fired up throughout the day, or tease her and flirt with her and get that build. And then when they ask in the evening, the wife's still cold. So they're uncomfortable about the whole process. And
right.
if you watch shows like Friends and some of the other stuff that modern guys have seen growing up, a lot of those guys are quite simpy and they're pestering women for sex. And they react like toddlers having tantrums when they don't get it. And there's actually no bigger turnoff for women than a guy who just sulks and complains. Instead, go and do something that she actually finds sexy, and then she'll come to you. That's the correct approach.
Yeah, what was the, I think at the summation, at the climax of your guys' sexual ethics episode, you guys said, there was some quote that was like, I'm going to butcher it, but as long as it's with, if it's procreative, unitive, and within marriage, basically everything's licit, and erring on the side of scrupulosity is going to do more harm to the marriage than good. Do you remember what quote I'm trying to reference here?
Yeah, to put it bluntly, the rule of thumb is that if you are actually finishing ejaculating inside your wife, then you don't need to be double guessing yourself the whole time. Like, simple as that. Because the more of that you do, the more of a passion killer it's going to be, and the less relaxed you'll be about it all.
And I think if we're looking like on a gradient of this, of chastity perhaps, or of sexual ethics, spending way more time over there will probably resolve a lot of the pains and woes that men and women are experiencing in marriage than spending time on the, like, well, maybe we should ask our priest if we're allowed to do this first. Like, my goodness. Okay. Next question has to do, now that we're speaking about virtues, this is a bit of a personal question, so feel free to pass if you don't want to answer it, or just substitute something that's approximate. But I was curious, what is a virtue that you guys have either lacked the most, or not lacked the most, but lacked for the longest period of time? And what has been your strategy to work on it?
Easy for me. Pride. I've always been in environments where you have to beat people at stuff, come first in the exam, first in the race, win whatever sports match you're in. And if you do that often enough, you start to get this idea that you're something special. If you get every job you ever go for, if when you're put into some kind of contest, you're coming out on top, your whole life becomes about that. It's really easy just to focus on the ways in which you're better than people. And that's actually drilled into you by those environments long-term as well. You know, it's not good enough to get 91% in the test. You have to get 99%+ in the test. It comes back to your red pill stuff, Nick, earlier. And the way to combat that is just to realize that not only all the good things about you and all these aptitudes that you can show off in those contexts, but even your very existence moment to moment isn't of your own doing. It all comes to you from God. And it's great to use that stuff, but it's cringe to think that you're somehow glorifying yourself with stuff that you're not responsible for. Sure, you can train in the gym or you can study hard, but the actual moment-to-moment preservation of your existence is from God, and all those gifts are from Him in the first place. So that's a great thing to think about during prayer to encourage humility.
Have you expressed this with your wife and at any point called on her to support you in growing in humility?
Yeah. Saying sorry when you're wrong about stuff, that's a big one. It's difficult for me to do because I get in the habit of thinking that because I'm generally right about stuff, I'm always right about stuff. And you can become blind when you're not, and you can get stubborn about it. So seeking counsel and just saying, what do you think about this? And then listening to someone else's viewpoint on it is a good habit that I've got into that's helped. She compares me to being like an ox, where you just stick it in the harness and say, go. And then whatever's in the way, eventually the ox thinks it can just tread down or break through. And then sometimes I do that and it's a stupid path to follow. You're just being the stereotypical big dumb ox. And there's a much better route that you haven't focused on because you're like, I'm gonna do this one because I set out this way and it has to happen.
Interesting. Tim, what about you?
I'd say pride, but from the opposite perspective. I would say I have a kind of pride where in all dimensions of my life, cutting across all categories, aside from maybe basketball, where I really put in work, I've always gotten by on talent and what I can store in my brain rather than, I should go check the stats. Sometimes it'll be even before a show, and I'll be like, I should check that stat. I'm like, I'm pretty sure I have a lot logged away. So whatever it is, perspiration is 90% of success. Inspiration is 10%. I'm always kind of inverting that if you look at the actual lived credo. So in a sense, it's kind of the opposite of Will. Will's the most talented, most gifted person, one of the most I've ever met. But like, given the store of whatever amount of talent a person has, I always try to maximize it. And I'll think of ways as I go about, here's a way to maximize it where I don't have to put in time. It is working very smart, but it's served me badly at some moments in my life. And even basketball, I love the movie Hustle, the Adam Sandler basketball movie. I think it's one of his best serious films, maybe his best one. So he has like basketball wounds from the way that his basketball career was limited, and that's how it was. So maybe it even figures into this as well. Like, man, if I'd just done, guys like Will are extremely talented and struggle with like, okay, could I work 25 hours in the day? Like, that's not possible. I'm a guy that in most areas of my life, particularly as a student, aside from the year I studied in Rome, it was like, get, you know, how, what's the high, how, you know, can I get the A or A minus with this much less study than everybody else? Let me try to figure out a way to do it.
Yeah, minimum effective dose.
Right, minimum effective dose. I'm a minimum effective dose guy. And it's like when it affects everything, even spending habits. I'm not by nature cheap. It's just minimum effective dose. So I'll be like, well, if this will do the job, I don't need the top of the line. So some guys are top of the line everything. I'm like, no, mm-hmm. I don't mind because, I mean, I'm buy expensive football and basketball cards. I'm definitely not cheap. And if someone needs something, I'm like, no problem. But for myself, I'm always minimum effective dose. And I know I can get by on that. People will say, oh man, these Pope Francis stats over the last 11 years, now an 11-year pontificate. When I do Rules for Retrograde shows on Francis, people are like, how long do you research before each show? And I'm like, I'd be embarrassed to tell you. Like, I have this stuff on lock and they're like dates. Like, I was talking about February the 18th, 2016, when Francis said that people could use rubbers because of Zika virus. And it was, you know, roughly a month and a half before Morris Letizia came out while we were waiting for it. People were asking, like, how do you just go check that? I'm like, I'll double check dates sometimes. But I said that it was February 17th or 18th to Steph when I was getting the show ready. So the amount of time I research for a show is embarrassingly little. And then I've told people that, like, that's cool. And I'm like, it's not, though. It's held me back in my life, even maybe in a way where I'm trying to set aside basketball as the one thing I gave everything I had. I don't even think that's true as I'm saying this answer. You know, I have basketball wounds from could have gone even further. And I don't think that's true. I think I always could have benefited by, you know, the well-known, like, oh, could I be in the gym the 25th hour of the day if there's some, you know, if I got like an 85 DeLorean or something. Will's always trying to figure that. I'm always like, okay, this is like a 3-hour shoot around workout. How can I get it down to two? I don't know. Maybe that's why we're a good team, Will and I, but like I have crippled myself by it. And I do think that, just scratch what I said at the beginning of this answer about basketball, is completely a carve out from the general rule. I think it's even hindered me there. And it's something I have deep nostalgic wounds about.
So you'd be like, but imagine that, you know, Aquinas died having written one book, and God's like, you know, you could have done some more.
He's like, I gave you literally all of it. Like I gave you the most. There was nothing left in the bottle. I gave you all of it, and you wrote one book.
God's like, dude, you gave me one book. I expected the Summa. You don't know what that is because you didn't write it in this. Also, the pub deadline, you got it in like 2 years late. Like, what's going on? And Aquinas is like, I had to sleep in. What do you want me to do? Get up at 9 a.m.? You know?
I just want to add, though, with because Tim's mentioned basketball there, talking about pride and this idea that you can either get by on doing very little and do a great job, or you can work so hard and somehow end up getting it perfect. If you look at just like the hard fact of diminishing returns in genetics, for example, someone can practice all hours in the day at basketball or weightlifting, whatever it is. You're still not going to get anywhere close to your ultimate potential at it just because of the fact of diminishing returns and your other duties in life. So it can end up really hurting you in all kinds of areas. And you need to just accept that you've got other stuff to do and perfection isn't yours to give yourself in that area. And that's a big lesson in humility too. You're not going to pull off all the things you think you're going to pull off.
It's funny how humility is the solution to both types of pride that you guys just described. It's like, it brings you down a little bit on, you know, Will, what you described, but also Tim, the concept of like, you're not all that. That's the thing. That's the point, is that, I don't know, there's just such a beautiful humbling in the other side of it too. Like, oh, cool. So you didn't write 15 books. You only wrote like 7. You think if you wrote 15 that you would be a great man?
You know? Well, it's the work is not going to do as much as I imagine, but also from what Tim's saying, he has to work a bit more than he imagines, because just going by what he's got stored in his mind or natural talent with zero effort isn't going to take him as far as he thinks.
Right.
Yeah. Well, just to, because that was somewhat of a self deprecating or a self critical question, I'll throw my answer in on this one. Tim, hearing you talk was scary. It was really scary because I was like, oh, yeah, that's totally what I've been doing. That's totally what I've been doing. That's so bad. I think the only other virtue that I've lacked as bad as whatever, or struggled with as bad as whatever you just described, whatever flavor of pride that is fortitude, which I think also has to do with what we just described, what you just described, that persistence. But for me, it always reflected not in like, oh, this is going to be a hard task, I'm therefore going to half-ass it, which I do tend toward, but more along the lines of, if there's an interpersonal conversation that's scary to me, because I'm going to have to hurt somebody's feelings, or it's the fear of abandonment or anything like that, I'll just take it on the chin. I'll take whatever ill will, resentful state of being, you know, this person's not paying me, this person's not fulfilling my expectations, instead of just telling them, like, I'll just deal with it. And that's a total lack of courage. And to, I think both of those deficiencies have been, I don't really necessarily have a strategy, I guess, for dealing with them. My strategy has simply been identifying that that's what I do. And then whenever that conversation comes up, now, because I'm knowledgeable, I'm fully culpable. It's like, shit, I have to call them now. Right. And that's super helpful to me. And Tim, I think I've seen this with you as well, that like the moment it's clearly explicated, you're like, okay, I'll do it. Like, if this is the task, if this is what it takes, I will do it, and I will do it exemplary.
But it's all of like the innovation. I think this is where like geniuses can be lazy sort of thing, because it's like, well, I'll just innovate away the problem before I even have to deal with it. And some problems is like, you kind of just have to deal with the problem.
The only way out is through with most problems. The only way out is not innovation. I mean, my family crest on my dad's side, I'm Scots. On my distaff side, I'm an Italian. But I found out that Gordon means a large, spacious fort, and I've always liked fighting. That's one thing I've never lacked this for. But and I found out that the family motto was "Animo non astutia," which means by courage, not by deceit, or by courage, not by craft. And I was like, all right, that there's a nomen est omen there, because I remember when I was an attorney the 1 year. What I really liked about the advice I got from the guy was about to become partner. His name was Bernie. You're not shocked at a law firm that my mentor was named Bernie. Good dude though. And I think he was a Christian of all things, but he was like, yo man, he was a really smart guy, and his dad was an attorney, and the guy whose name hung on the door, Kush, his dad was an attorney, and I was like the only guy there that whose dad wasn't an attorney. My dad's a scientist. And like Bernie was like, oh, my dad taught me this, like, you do, you know, always show opposing counsel exactly what we have, and we're going to beat him in the courtroom. We're not going to paper him under. We're not going to give him too much info, which is a trick lawyers use. We're definitely not going to give him too little, because that's illegal. No tricks, no bullshit. We're going to beat him by arguments and evidence in the courtroom, and we'll show them exactly what they have. And I've always loved that. I love this story about Larry Bird in the 87 playoffs, where he was telling his defender every, you know, I'm going to do this. I'm going to come off this double screen. I'm going to curl. I'm going to hit a 21 footer right in your eye. And he would did it for every play of the game, just to keep himself interested, because he was that good. Like, I like that, like animo non astutia. And yeah, so that figures into what you're saying somehow, but I do favor that direct sort of controversy or whatever.
I just want to point out that you could easily argue that ultimately all sins reduce to pride.
Right.
Pride and disobedience, because it's basically saying that, you know best, and you don't want to follow what God's expectations or commands are for you. And this is why when you listen to the saints talk about themselves, they're all saying they're struggling with pride. And if someone is saying that they don't struggle with pride, it's normally a sign that they seriously are. It's a funny way it works out.
Yeah.
Or they're very confused by the different faces that pride can take. Because like,
right,
you guys just described two facades of pride that sound completely opposite, and it's not. It's pride in both ways.
You can probably sum up the most of the spiritual life. I don't know whether all of it, but most of it, of there's a constant crossroads all the time, every moment, and you've got pride leading to hell and then humility to heaven, and you're always hanging in the balance.
And when you finally understand, this is another thing that I wish I could tell my 17-year-old self, is that pride is not accurate, humility is accurate. Like, the delusion is pride, and humility is not lying. Humility is not false in saying, I'm scum of the earth, I'm dirt, I'm nothing. It's like, well, that's not true either, you know, and we're not Calvinists here. You're good, God loves you, he made you well and called you good, and you're called to something higher. Humility is seeing yourself as God sees you, and pride is being utterly deluded about that. And so the thought that I was terrified by Christianity for so long was, if I follow God, I will be annihilated. Everything that I am, everything that I want to be, all that is good, all that I identify with is going to be annihilated, because that's what, you know, true humility is. It's like, well, that's not true at all. It's just that pride is creating these phantasms, these delusions of something that you truly are not. And those are going to be annihilated. And if you create a sense of self out of them, then of course it will be excruciatingly painful for them to be destroyed. So it's a point of clarification for 17-year-old Nick that will never hear what I have to say.
Yeah, look at the average woman who works like a glorified secretary job, and she likes to buy the pumps and the power suit to go in. And she's like more excited to go into her job than like network execs are at NBC. You're like, you're bad at this, or it's unimportant. Just go home, be a mom, love your husband and kids well, and you'll be doing a billion times more good. And they get wounded. You're telling them good news.
Right, right.
I mean, yeah. I am. This is what I've been doing the last 5 years since I announced on Matt Fred's show in summer of 2019 that I was writing this book, like, Case for Patriarchy. Women, it's good news. It's the gospel. It's the gospel of the 21st century. All the good news, all you have to do is go home from your job, get in. I mean, don't get in sweats. You should still look nice around the house, but you don't have to buy a new power suit twice a season. Just go be nice to your wife and to your husband and your kids, and things are going to be, your life will be so much great, better. And
that's what I found your chapter 6 of Case for Patriarchy to be, was like, to me, it was like good news, breath of fresh air to me as a young man thinking like, oh, I have to conquer the entire world to have succeeded as a man and go to heaven. And in chapter 6, you're like, no, you just have to be like virtuous and like a good dad. And if you make like 60K a year and you do that, that's like you're winning. I just felt this like, oh, thank goodness. This is like, I'm like, I can do that. Like, I'd rather, much rather do that.
Nick, I've got to head off for a lesson now, but I've got my quote for the day for that. This is St. Philip Neri, who says that a man should keep himself down and not busy himself in what is too high for him.
Wow.
Keep himself down and not busy himself in what is too high for him.
You've got to send Tim and I that in our chat.
That's his insight into this topic for the day. He's got so many great one-liners. I've collected a bunch of them. Obedience is a shortcut to perfection. Obedience.
Wow. Wow.
Very good. Very good.
Well, great to speak to you as always, guys. And looking forward to next week's show with Mike back again.
Yes. All right, Will. God bless you.
Take care. You too.
Bye.
Well, I over-prepared out of fear of under-preparing for the show, which I guess is
very
good.
Well. That's very well of you.
I guess that's good. I will save these questions as much as I want to rattle them off to you now and just keep interviewing you. I'll save them for the next Q&A show. I have less to prepare for next time. See how I can be both Will and Tim simultaneously.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, like now I don't have to do anything for the next 2 months, even pay rent probably.
Yeah, I'm taking care of that too.
Cool. I'm sure my landlord gets it.
And then I'm going to make a note for, and I'll just tease the audience about the wedding rings, because this is actually something you and I agree on and we disagree with Will on.
Which is rare. Yeah.
Which is extremely rare. And I love
that we disagree with Will. Yeah.
That we disagree with Will. And I love that it's on something that's like kind of doesn't matter.
Right.
It's like we agree on all the most important things. And then it's like, wedding rings. All right, whatever.
Yeah.
But well, that was a lot of fascinating answers. I feel better having asked you guys, so thank you so much, and thank you to everybody who's listening. Tim, parting shots before we sign off.
Yeah, I think it's cool to ask influencers things that they're mildly uncomfortable sharing, like weaknesses. I mean, I'm not particularly rib defensive. I don't think Will is either, but I didn't know any of these questions you were going to ask me here today, and neither did Will, and I think it comes off lordly yet human to be asked these things and be like, okay, I'll answer these questions. I wish more influencers on big time shows would have someone ask them embarrassing or humbling stuff, the in real time, and they have to give an extemporaneous answer, I think that would be cool. And you can't like deflect. I'm not just trying to like sing our praises for not deflecting. I just think it's really a healthy exercise toward humility, privately, publicly, on internet spaces. And it's fun to do, because you don't even, and I'm not defensive by nature, I'm sort of an open book, but you don't want to say something that you're going to put on the internet forever and like say too much. Like, oh man, I was even, oh man. I the funny thing is, of all the answers I gave, me talking about basketball and my basketball career is one of the hardest things. One of the only things I get defensive about. So that's a funny aspect of my personality. But I enjoy it, and there are good, thoughtful questions. So thanks.
Yeah, of course. All right, you guys, we'll tune in next Friday for the show led by Mr. Mike Pantile, our Canadian friend.
Isn't that funny? It's a very international show. CMask became international.
That's true, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, three nations being represented, and also like just a panoply of rainbow of colors from cream white to eggshell white. You know,
yeah,
it's three nations.
We just understand
broadband spectrum of whiteness.
We just understand that, you know, diversity is our greatest strength here at CMAS. All right, we'll see you guys next week. God bless. You want to kill the recording? I can't do it from my end.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.